outer space atmosphere. 836 with John Landecker. Yes, when we say outer space, you know what that means. Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine and host of This Week in Space podcast. Good evening, Rod Pyle. How are you?
Good evening, John. I'm good. What was that music tag from?
That is from the soundtrack to 2001 A Space Odyssey. And it's called...
Oh, that was part of the going down to Jupiter psychedelic.
It's called
I'm 10 years old and trying to figure out what the hell's going on in the movie theater.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's called Atmosphere. That's the name.
I edited
it down because there's a lot of atmosphere, so to speak.
Oh, although it's in a space, week. Yeah.
So
do you remember?
Yes.
Just for a second, do you remember seeing that for the first time? I mean, I had gone to this movie thinking, "This is great. This is true sci-fi. No more spaceships on strings. This will be unbelievable." And the first half was a little depressing because the crew's getting killed and all that. But then this whole thing with the light show and all that, and I'm looking at this young kid thinking, we paid $30 a ticket for this because it was, you know, this limited release thing. And then what really got me was when they cut to this one shot, a couple of shots, it was really clear. It was like colored paint that they were mixing, remember?
Which scene are we talking about here?
This is the ending of 2001 where he's going down to Jupiter in the spacecraft.
Okay.
Before he ends up in the white room eating poached eggs and all that nonsense.
Gotcha.
Anyway, there was some really goofy stuff in it. It's like, come on, I can spot paint. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm ranting.
No. As a matter of fact, I've watched it again, a couple of years ago. And I don't know if they've... what they've done to it, but I'm telling you, I thought the special effects of the space station revolving were like state of the art. I mean, it was seamless.
Those are models, and they were done beautifully. And I think it was Doug Trumbull, so that was one of his first things.
Yeah.
I just read the other day they found and have put in a museum in Hollywood or West LA. The spacecraft that takes them from the orbiting Hilton Space Station to the moon, the spherical thing.
Mm.
But most of the rest of it got left in a vacant lot after the filming of the movie. And it was either scrapped or stolen.
You know, I don't recall at all how well it was received initially. Was it well received? I mean, because it's 2001 A Space Odyssey is, for lack of a better term, a trip and a half.
I mean, it was transformational in terms of the visuals, and there's nothing like it before, certainly, and not for a long time after. I mean, it wasn't done that long after Lost in Space.
Right.
I'm comparing apples and oranges here, but there wasn't much out there. Up till then, everything kind of looked like typical studio.
Yes.
We can see the wires, you know, the people that are floating or kind of waving their hands around, and you can tell they're standing up, but they turn the camera sideways and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was certainly transformational that way. But, you know, I actually don't actually remember how it did in terms, because they didn't spout off about, you know, box office revenue and all that in the public back in those days.
Right, you're right.
Variety or something, yeah.
But, I mean, certainly a couple of iconic things at least was the opening bum 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 bum, and that whole bit about open the pod doors. What was it?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Yeah, open the pod bay doors, Hal. I mean, that has lived on to this very day. It's still a good movie. I like I said, I watched it again, and you know, I got a better sound system. I've got a 4K print on a TV, and I'm cranking the volume up, and yeah, it's good. It's good. Okay.
Knowing you radio hosts, you probably have like an 80-foot screen at home in your screening room, right?
No, I do not have an 80-foot. I have a 55, actually.
It's okay. Got it.
But it's a real good one. Just let me put it that way. It's a real good one. Rod Pyle is with us, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine and host of This Week in Space podcast. Let's do something along the lines of, you're the expert. I love this. Let's recap the year in space, so to speak, 2022.
So 2022 was a watershed year in a lot of ways. The big news, a couple of big news items, but something that didn't make a lot of headlines was SpaceX launching 61 times without a failure of the Falcon 9, which is more than any country except China, which launched 64 times. But that's everything and everybody in the military and private and government and everything else in China. Just SpaceX launched 61 times, sometimes twice in the day. And in that same year, they reused one of their boosters. They hit a new record 15 times. They're only designed to fly 10 times. So these guys are really, they're just knocking it dead. So the big question is, this year, in the first quarter, are they going to finally be able to get their big mega rocket Starship to do their orbital test? So that's what we're kind of all tapping our feet over now. It's looking good, but there's a lot of, you know, they had some trouble with the FAA. And they got that ironed out, they think. And people, you know, they don't issue a lot of news, but people who peer through the fence down in South Texas where they're testing this thing have been saying, oh, you know, part of it's headed to the scrapyards. So they can use this one instead of that one and all that. But it looks like they're going to do this test flight. So it'll go up, make most of an orbit, and then splash down next to Hawaii. They'll probably try to recover it, but it's not assured. But basically, it's just make sure it goes up and glides back properly. So that will be very cool.
What is unique about this space it's called a Starship, you said.
It's a two-stage rocket, bigger than the Saturn V, more than twice as powerful as the Saturn V. It can carry 100 tons to the moon, 150 tons into orbit. So it's basically like having a couple of semi-trucks with rocket engines on them. You know, it's just enormous, and it's completely reusable. So it's transformational on so many levels. It's really hard to convey what a big difference this could mean, because if it turns out to work, and if it's reusable, as they say, and if it can fly with frequency, you can start delivering not just little robots and a couple people at a time to the moon, but chunks of communities and huge machines and earth movers and, you know, drive-in theaters if you want to up to the moon. So it's a real game changer just in terms of the stuff we can do. So that was big. Yeah. And of course, the other big one, I know you probably got to go to break pretty soon, but the Webb Space Telescope, of course, James Webb Space Telescope was just enormous. And, you know, we were all kind of gritting our teeth and crossing our digits when that thing launched, and then it heads off towards the moon, and something like 470 separate mechanical activities have to take place for it to fully unfold and clamp in place and all that. And remember, this is something that's never been tested in zero-G. It's always just been fiddled with and tested on Earth under full gravity. And you can't always predict how things are going to behave out there, plus the extreme temperatures and all that. But it succeeded brilliantly. And so far, we all saw those early pictures, but there's been stuff since then. They got an early indication of water on an exoplanet. They decided to look at some close-in objects. They got some incredible images of Jupiter, running list of oldest and furthest galaxies. Seems like there's a new one every other week. Spotted some carbon dioxide in an exoplanet, which is interesting because it's, you know, that's a possible indicator of some form of life. And just all kinds of stuff in the very earliest universe. And finally, this exoplanet system called TRAPPIST-1, which has, I think, 7 planets, of which 4 are in the so-called habitable zone, which could be somewhat Earth-like. They've got to look at those, and they'll be looking at that more. But, you know, you see the stuff, you get the data, then you got to have 6 months to a year to figure out what it all means. So the best stuff is yet to come.
We're talking to Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, host of This Week in Space podcast. Obviously, he knows how we work around here because, we're going to take a break and come back with more on 720 WGN.
So we had the DART mission, which is Double Asteroid Redirect Test, and the idea of this was the first test of, hey, if we see an asteroid or a comet coming towards Earth, if we throw something at it hard enough, will it divert it? Right. So, you know, a little spacecraft about the size of a golf cart. They ran it into a moonlet that was orbiting another asteroid. It was all very weird dynamics. It was about 500 feet, but still 500 feet across, the big rock. Slammed into it at a very high rate of speed, and it was not only successful, but it changed the trajectory and the orbital time of that little object about 3 times what they expected. So I think it was a total of 33 minutes of orbital period. They had hoped maybe 10. And it displaced 2 million pounds of rock. So they figured out what happened was so much rock blew off of the thing during the impact that that acted like a little momentary rocket engine and kind of pushed it along. So they learned a whole lot about how we can, you know, possibly intervene if it's early enough with something heading towards Earth, which is good because we don't want to lose Chicago to a big rock, right?
No, no. And we've all seen the movie Armageddon, and who needs that? So, I mean, it's nice to know that they sent something up there, it hit the thing, and it moved it. I mean, that's really, what more could you possibly ask for, right?
Yeah. So, so now we got to figure out how to do it for bigger objects, and that's a long conversation we'll have another time, because the elephant in the room, of course, is Artemis 1.
Artemis 1.
A rated spaceship out to the moon and back, and there's no people in it, but it worked brilliantly after all those waits and all the snarky remarks I made. So it finally took off, flew for 20-something days brilliantly, few electrical glitches, but I mean, it went out, you know, it launched fine, it went out there fine, completed its big loop fine, came back, and the big moment, of course, was will this heat shield, the first one we built to return lunar speeds, which is like, you know, 25,000 miles an hour instead of 17,000, will it work? Did, haven't heard anything about cracks or issues with that, so that's good, but my favorite part of that mission was they had an iPad or some kind of a screen in the cockpit that had a space-rated version of Alexa on it from Amazon called Calista. But it couldn't phone home to Amazon service, so it had everything in place, right? So it's kind of simple. It's like, you know, how much gas do we have? The lights on or off? So the two dummies they had strapped in the seats, two or three, interacted with this thing. They had a camera over their shoulders. Well, Lockheed Martin said, hey, let's let the public send in messages we can flash on the screen, and they can see their kind of messages, a selfie. At the furthest point, as it was orbiting past the moon, a little text message pops up on that screen that some guy called Block Sender sent. It says, we're calling about the expired warranty on your spacecraft.
No. Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And Lockheed Martin and NASA let him put it up. So I thought that was really, really fun.
That's astounding. That is astounding. Now, wait a minute. I just want to make sure I'm understanding what's going on here. This thing's flying around, and it has a screen, and it's out of some kind of Alexa-like device.
Right.
And somebody could text this message to the craft?
You had to send it to Lockheed Martin, the contractor that built the Orion, and then they looked at it because they didn't want anything geeky going up there, you know.
I could see that.
You know, they didn't want John Linebacker, you know, setting up his like favorite off-color joke of the week or something, or heaven forbid me. So, they vetted it and then they sent it. But this is a way to get the public involved, and that certainly is different from what we remember about Apollo.
I mean, you know, there's sci-fi and sci-fact, and the lines are getting more and more blurred. You know, the thing that always strikes me about this, when we're talking to Rod Pyle, by the way, editor-in-chief of Ad Astro Magazine, host of This Week in Space Podcast, and all these things that we've been talking about, unless I'm wrong, everything that we talk about is, with maybe one or two exceptions, these are being funded by either Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, Artemis is a huge government program, billions of dollars. So that's not. But Starship and the Falcon 9, you know, it was self-funded to start. He still puts a lot of money into it, but they've had NASA contracts going since 2006. So there's a lot of NASA money in the mix, same with Bezos. So they're smart, you know. It's easy to look at it the way it's usually put in the press and think, wow, these guys are flying their own space program. I wish Apple would do that. You know, we'd be on Jupiter already. But it's a kind of a complicated mix. So they got NASA contracts. They've got contracts with the military, private contracts with other. So, like, this is a weird one, you know, in a sense of co-opetition, if you want to call it that.
Yes.
SpaceX, you know, they've been launching all these Starlink satellites. They can have broadband from orbit, right? Well, there's another company called OneWeb that was supposed to use a Russian-powered rocket. That fell through, so they came to SpaceX and said, hey, you know, we know we're your competition, but would you mind launching our satellites? They said, write us a check. So, you know, it's a very interesting the way this whole business angle is coming together. And, you know, the next 5 or 6 years are really just going to be dynamite if Musk doesn't get eaten alive by Twitter, which, you know, jury's still out.
One never knows. He's an eccentric dude. That's an understatement. One thing I want to get to before we run out of time.
Sure.
This, because I talked about it on the air, I think a few weeks ago, in late January, and late January is not that far away.
Yes.
A rare green comet in the northwestern skies, the last time for 50,000 years, and as I understand it, in some areas, if everything's right, you can see it with the naked eye. Is that right?
Well, so we're going to do this on the podcast of Friday, and I'm titling the episode The Creepy Green Comet.
Okay.
And it's not creepy. It's Comet C2022E3, parentheses, ZTF, in parentheses. First time in 50,000 years. And in fact, it may not come back at all because the orbit looks like it may sling out of the orbit that would bring it past Earth. It's not huge. You know, it's fairly small. It's going to be hard to spot. But increasingly towards the end of the month, we're moving towards the western sky. So, yeah, if you can get out there. So this is an early morning object. In about a week and a half, it'll be close to the small to the Little Dipper. And then it'll continue moving west night after night, kind of in the northern part of the sky from our viewpoint. The key is you got to get out of town. So you got to get out where it's really dark, which is increasingly hard to do. Yeah. There's a website called darksky.org that will give you the nearest really dark spot near you. So if you're willing to drive a couple hours or, you know, stay up most of the night, bring a pair of binoculars. You're going to need them. Probably don't need a telescope. But it's really, you know, green is pretty rare for comets. They're usually kind of a whitish blue. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to going out and seeing it.
What gives it the color?
It's atomic oxygen, I think.
Wow. Atomic oxygen.
It's atomic. Like all those movies in the 1950s. It's atomic. Yeah. Remember?
Oh, yeah. Here comes Flash Gordon on his spaceship, and there's a bunch of strings attached to it. Yeah.
That's right. But his little ray gun is atomic. I'm glad you brought that up because I want to make sure we mention that. That's really special.
I mean, it's one thing to talk about all these other great things, the SpaceX and going, you know, Artemis and all that, and that's all really cool, but when we can bring it actually, no pun intended, down to all of us here at Earth and we can participate in something like that, I think that's really cool. I mean,
And as long as we're talking about those deep space objects, the time we have left, the OSIRIS-REx mission ejected a capsule, and that's going to be coming back to Earth this year, and it's going to have samples from asteroid Bennu.
Wow.
So we'll get to fondle a little bit of a deep space object, which isn't something we get to do every day.
That's for sure.
That sound quite right, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. I'm sure everybody knew what you were getting to. Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief at Astro Magazine, host of This Week in Space podcast, which you just mentioned, which is going to drop when, the podcast?
Friday afternoon, about 5 o'clock your time.
And you're going to be dealing some more about this this comet, yes?
Yeah, we're going to talk to an astronomer and planetarium director of New York State that I've known for a long time. And you can find it on Spotify or Google or Apple or the space.com website.
Awesome. Rod Pyle, thank you so much for being with us. Always great to
talk
to
you.
Look to talk to you again. Here at 720 WGN, Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief at Astro Magazine, host of This Week in Space podcast.